Blog Talk Radio.
As the tears are falling from my face, with all my fears I long for your embrace. How am I gonna carry on and be the one you leave?
Another episode of Continue Mission, and you know, we don't have the storyline lined up because we wanted to talk about current events, and then we also wanted to talk a little bit and dive into the issue of traumatic brain injuries as it relates to our veterans and what the VA is and is not doing, largely more so not doing, to assist those veterans that live in rural communities. You know, one would think, and many people are under the misconception, that once you serve in the military, you get out, you're taken care of for the rest of your life. Well, that's not true. In most cases, what you find is that people move back to their rural communities, which is generally 3 to 4 hours from the nearest VA medical center. And if they hope to utilize any of their VA benefits, first, they have to sign up for it. Second, they have to qualify for that service. And third, they have to get there. And that sometimes is a big challenge. We're working with a couple of organizations. Vets for Vet Leadership is working with Resurrecting Lives and Dr. Chris Ann Gordon on this traumatic brain injury issue. There is a map to a lot of people talk about suicides in America and suicides among those with a traumatic brain injury. Those rates are much higher. So let's just talk about the 22 a day that you're everybody talking about, veterans facing 22 suicides a day. There's generally markers legs to this race that lead to the eventual final solution in these people's lives, and that is the suicide. And it generally starts with a lack of employment, followed by some sort of substance abuse, followed by poverty, followed by homelessness, followed by incarceration, and the final step is suicide. Now, this doesn't happen in every case, but in many cases it does. The VA established a program called The Choice. A lot of us really appreciated it, especially the younger veterans. But there were some veterans organizations, namely in the FW and the American Legion, that were not happy about that. And some of the members that, especially those that were in positions of authority within these organizations, the majority of them lived within a reasonable commute, within an hour's drive of their VA hospital. They were under the impression that somehow this is going to take away from the VA and take away from their personal care, failing to realize that 75% of those that serve live in rural communities. That's a fact, folks. And the majority that live close to these hospitals are happy and they utilize these services fine and well. But do we have an obligation to take care of our veterans, yes or no? The VA medical system has no one on their staff, that is what you would classify as a traumatic brain injury specialist. And that's nowhere in the VA healthcare system. As a matter of fact, only 10 to 15% of the doctors in America are trained and can adequately deal with traumatic brain injuries. How about that? When you think about that, out of those 10 to 15%, none of them are working for the VA. I wonder why? Because they don't make any money in the VA, and they can make a heck of a lot more money on here where people pay their bills. The Choice Program, a great program, but many doctors have stopped accepting it because the VA simply is not timely or efficient in paying their bills. And this last 18 months has been the worst in the history of the Choice Program for paying the bills. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're also going to talk about the current debates that are going on in Washington, D.C., some of the things, some of the campaigns that are out there. You know, are we going to see a flip in the House and the Senate? Maybe, maybe not. One thing that is definitely signaling that there may not be any change is the fact that the GOP in particular has stopped funding many elections. And I just received this today. I want to read just a few minutes ago. Yeah, a few minutes ago. The GOP Super PAC is to stop spending in the New Hampshire Senate races. Imagine that. They're going to stop funding. The last 2 weeks, they're going to stop funding. And you know, here's the thing. You've got to push this over the line. I don't know whether or not they've given up on these races, but it's key races, and it's primarily races where we've got armed forces veterans of this country, honorable veterans, that are running in tough races. They were asked to run. They were encouraged to run. And then now that they're in the race and they're almost to the finish line, they're being left on the landing zone, abandoned in the middle of a firefight by the very organization that should be taking care of them. And understand, folks, I don't have a problem calling out right wing or left wing. As a matter of fact, they're both two wings on the same chicken. And I can tell you this, that we have just as many problems on the left as you have on the right. And when they do things like stopping the funding of Senate races, millions and millions of dollars that they're setting aside and saving and hoarding for God knows what, maybe to fight legal fees, I don't know, maybe to hire more attorneys or more staffers. It all looks like a big power play, either side of the political aisle. Most of them do not want to see more veterans in Congress or the Senate. Why? Because veterans are known to work across the aisle. Why? Because veterans are also known to go the extra mile, and veterans, for the most part, are not for sale. Now, we've had a few sell out up there. I can name a few, but I'll save that for another date. They have become loyal to the party, and they fear standing up against the party. And we've got one on the GOP side, and we've got one on the Democrat side. And they have become a big disappointment to the veterans community. And my hope is that the constituents that can change that will make some decisions that will do exactly that, and that's change those people. Now, we realize that just because a person's a veteran doesn't mean that they're naturally qualified to lead or be an elected senator or congressman. As a matter of fact, we think that you, the voters, should go and look at every single one of them. However, what you are finding is most incumbents, about 98% of the incumbents on both sides, refuse to debate, refuse to have public open dialogue because they simply don't feel the need. And they honestly feel that anyone that runs against them is below them, regardless of who they are, regardless if it's a disabled veteran that lost, you know, a leg or an eye or an arm or something in combat. It doesn't matter to them. What matters is that they want to retain that power. And that's what's wrong with America. And you, the American people, the voters, you can stop pulling these straight tickets and you can go in and actually vote for people. Yes, sometimes that means you're going to vote for somebody else in another party that maybe isn't all the way aligned with you. But you know what you got. Okay? You know what you got right now with some of these folks. And maybe it's time for most of them to change, not just a few. America's crime wave keeps soaring and soaring, folks. We see unthinkable, unspeakable crimes that are going on. Entire families are being abducted and murdered. A family is now missing in Michigan. An entire family was murdered. Little kids. Unbelievable. And we see violence on the television, and we see disgusting, revolting nastiness in some of these events that are occurring in public locations where kids are at. You know, I watched this disturbing video of a cross-dresser, transgender, whatever you want to call them, dressed like a woman. It's a man, okay? Singing a song about a woman's vagina, but using the other word for that. You know, swinging their legs around, showing the in between their legs. They didn't care. And there were kids in this place. Now, I fault the parents for bringing those children into that place. But these are the nasty and the foul things that are playing out all across America, in your schools, in your churches even. Some churches have now opened the doors. The church's doors should be open to all people, but not specifically calling out saying, hey, when all may come and be welcome, not just the LGBTQ community. You know, when churches open that up and they say that it's okay, they're not preaching the gospel. Bottom line, it's okay for anybody to go into church, and you should go into church, whether you're LGBTQ. That's not my business. That's between you and God. But we shouldn't make a church service focused around you and your sexual desires, whatever they may be. We don't do that for other heterosexuals. We shouldn't do that for homosexuals or trans or whatever. You know, we have a level of respect and dignity and modesty. Modesty. Anyways, we got Rich and got Father Pichel on here. We're going to have a good evening this evening. So I brought in a lot of things, talked about a lot of things, guys. Let's start with this last thing that we were talking about. Some of this appalling sexual deviant behaviors that are occurring in public places in front of children. Is this normal? Is this something that, you know, would have been acceptable 30 years ago? You know, what do you think, guys?
I saw the same thing you did, James, and I don't know if you noticed the people behind this obscene person had no expression on their face. I think they were even embarrassed, but it was so foul. And the little children, it really is a level of child abuse. You're violating their consciences. You're violating their hearts. They're not able to form their own thoughts. So I think it's despicable. And I think if you have so-called churches hosting such a thing, that's not a thing of acceptance in the love of Jesus. Like you said, that's promoting something, because the scripture is very explicit about modesty. So I concur with you. And really, we've lost our dignity and sense of a moral standard when you defile children like that with such an obscene display. I don't even know what you want to call it, but that I saw the same thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, and I will tell you that when people spoke out against this, they are venomously attacked. You know, like, it's like, how dare you, you know, question this person's right to just do and say whatever they want, you know. They had parades, they being, you know, this LGBTQ community in America and Canada in particular, where they literally walked down the street dressed like women but had their pants off and was fondling their own genitals and swinging their you-know-what around, and there's kids out there watching this parade. I don't understand it. And you know, you would get arrested for that. There was a song called The Streak. And, you know, people were going around and getting undressed and running nude through communities, and they got arrested for that. You know, it was an indecent exposure. I don't understand. Law enforcement dare not touch it because, you know, they'll lose their job. They'll burn their house down. You know, they'll call them a fascist. You know, that's the name that everything gets. If you speak out against this foulness, you're not a Bible thumper anymore. That's what they used to call us. Now it's you're a fascist. You're a fascist. What do you think, Rich?
Well, I didn't see the video. My first question is, you said it was a public place. Did the people there have a choice to watch it or walk away?
Oh, they could have walked away. Yeah, absolutely. That's why I hold parents.
Why didn't they?
Exactly.
Why
I
didn't
don't know.
They? That's,
I don't know.
My point is, if you're being obscene and you create an audience, that's what the person wants to do. So why are you watching it? Right?
Yeah.
And why is the parents? You know, I'm you're blaming the person putting on the scene. I'm blaming the people who are watching it. And
but I think it's almost like shock therapy, though. I think when you see something so appalling, sometimes you almost freeze. There were maybe six women behind this lady. And I'm telling you, looking in their faces, now you're absolutely right, Rich. You have the freedom and the free will to make a choice. But I think sometimes when they're trying to use this shock therapy, I think they were appalled and maybe didn't know what to do, but they got sucked into it. I'm just saying, that's just my perspective.
Yeah. Okay. Because, see, I look at – look, we had a BLM protest in Colonial Williamsburg. Mm-hmm. And evidently everybody knew about it but us. My wife and I, we were going down there for our regular evening walk, okay? And we noticed that there was a lot of parking available. And I'm like, what's going on here? And then we get there, and then we can see something's going on down by the House of Burgesses. And then we find out, you know, it's like, imagine having a BLM protest with like 30 people, 32 people, and no audience. No audience whatsoever. That would be embarrassing. And it was. Okay? And we did our walk. And the police did a great job because they were scattered all over the place. Because you only saw like one car and a couple people, plain clothes. But when we walked around the other street, that's where we saw all the other police. Because, of course, they're not concerned about the protest. They're worried about destruction of these historic buildings, okay? That's why they were there, you know, because that's the biggest concern we have because, you know, the Colonial Williamsburg is our biggest tourist draw, okay? So,
right.
So you know, I got to say, you're condemning the person for doing it. I'm condemning the people for watching it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that makes a lot of sense.
Let's go back to that example, though, Rich. Let's go back to that example, like in 2020, there were spectators, I'm sure, but there were a lot of vicious people that destroyed a lot of property. The one thing that broke my heart was in Baltimore. It had been in construction for 8 years. It was for low income and elderly housing, cost $16 million. Now, there were some people that were caught up in being a spectator. But I think the more culpable person is the person who lit on fire, who assaulted people, and things of that nature. I hear what you're saying, and we can be
I think we're talking about two different things here. I think we're talking about it, two entirely different things.
No, I'm not.
Things.
I'm not.
We're not
I'm
talking about violence. We're not talking about violence. We're talking about lewd conduct, okay?
Right.
In front of
But you're still caught up as a spectator, if you're out there as an innocent marcher, and then others begin to burn down buildings, you know, pound police cars, start hitting people.
I got it. Mm-hmm. I got it. That's wrong. Definitely that's wrong. Should not be tolerated. And the cities, the mayors that allowed that to happen should be removed from office if they, you know, or be sued. They should be sued by the business, okay? But anyway, no, this conversation was not about, you know, rioting and violence. I only made that reference to BLM because there was no audience. They were out there chanting and stuff. They had no audience. So here in Williamsburg, we handled it right, okay? We didn't provide them an audience. And mm-hmm. whenever the – I remember when the KKK came to Yorktown to have a protest.
I remember that. We were in the Army.
And we were all – we received the notification that none of us were allowed to watch that, attend it. And, it of course, it shows up on the TV that day, and you look around in the audience. So you got these KKK guys up there chanting and stuff like that. They have no audience. That's embarrassing, right?
But one of our soldiers got caught out because I had to counsel him, and he got thrown out. He was a transporter, but he was really a trained lawyer, and he couldn't get into the JAG Corps, and everybody disowned him. And I talked with him for quite a long time, but I guess they found literature in his home and so on and so forth. And he said he was curious, but the general told us, Awfully.
Hey, look, we had to put a soldier out of the in my first unit when I was a lieutenant. We had to put a soldier out who openly admitted joining the KKK, which is illegal in the Army. You can't belong. They have a list of all these organizations that are against the Constitution of the United States. That's how we can kick them out. Okay, and he was, the guy wasn't a racist. He was friends with blacks and stuff like that. But this is back when David Dukes was the Grand Wizard.
Yeah.
And of course, what David Dukes' big theme was, he was pushing against racial quotas. Racial quotas is completely unfair. Okay. And he's not, you know, and David Duke, because of that message, attracted a lot of new people to the KKK, and this guy was one of them. And he felt it was his, because he joined the organization to understand what this message was all about. He wanted to read more about it, okay? And because it was a real headache for the company because he'd have to put him out. But I got to know the kid, and I'm like, he's a really nice kid. And he was telling me about how they had their meetings and how many members of the KKK that were actually in the Army, and they're not getting kicked out because they hide it. He thought, you know, he had the right to, you know, belong to any organization he wanted, and it was sad to see him.
I had
a
chaplain in chaplain school whose father was a Grand Wizard, and he and I went at it the whole time. He wasn't really in shape and ready for it. He broke his leg, but he still stayed through. I guess he was going to be, but man, you know, he says, well, you know, they deal with the white trash too. And you know, he was like trying to justify as a Christian minister. Yep. And I tell you, we went wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just pointing out that, you know, there's two parties here that are guilty.
Mm-hmm.
The person who's conducting the Loot Act and the people who are giving him an audience.
Right.
Well, I agree with that part. I agree that there has to be, you know, it's self-control, self-responsibility, accepting responsibility. And, you know, but it's just infiltrate. I'll tell you what it is. It's like, and you all know exactly what I'm getting ready to say. It is the numbing of the senses. I remember as a kid that if you heard somebody say hell on a television program, everybody put their hands over their mouth and was like, oh my goodness, censored all of that stuff out. And then, you know, you didn't have adult shows on until after, you know, 8, 9 o'clock at night. I'm sure y'all remember that. And somewhere,
hey, remember Gone with the Wind? How shocked everybody was with a closing remark. You know, I don't give a damn.
Right.
That was I don't give a damn. You know,
frankly,
that really that upset a lot of people that he said that in a movie.
Yeah.
Frankly,
well, I mean,
my dear, I don't. That's what it was. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, I don't remember. I remember it in the movie. Obviously, we weren't around to get the full effect when it originally came out. But, you know, we remember the movie, and we've done a lot of studying on it. But it's like, you know, look, you would never see the things on television in 1982 or 1972 that you see right now on television. You would never
see
that.
All right. Let me address that. Okay. Because when my dad was alive and I would call him up and I'd talk to him, and oh my God, he would sit there and talk about all the pornography on public television, you know, because there's, you know, look, when we grew up, when you and I grew up and we watched these family shows, married couples couldn't sleep in the same bed.
Yes,
right.
That's right.
I forgot what movie it was that actually had a married couple in the same bed. They slept in separate beds. That's what we grew up with, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, they're doing everything but actually getting close to undressing, and they're sleeping. My dad's like, oh, that's all pornography and stuff. Like, oh, he'd get so upset about it. And, I thought it was funny to talk to him, but I said, yeah, so where you could say we have become numbed to it. But my point is, you go to Europe, look,
yeah,
advertising shows nudity. Nobody, look, art. You go, you know, like, you look at any of the, look, we in Richmond, they had the Michelangelo Sistine Chapel exhibit there.
I went
to
it.
Panels. You did? We can talk about that when I go to church. Mm-hmm. I loved it. But again, you know, you got that big mural behind the altar. There's a lot of nudity there, okay?
Right.
People going to heaven, people going to hell, a lot of nudity there.
Mm-hmm.
Europeans are not as offended by the human anatomy as Americans are, and I'm going to have to blame the damn Puritans for that, okay? Yeah, we have a different culture here in America when it comes to how we view nudity than Europeans do. They just don't think anything about it. The human body is beautiful. Okay, you go and, you know, and that's the thing is, my wife, when she was looking at all the Michelangelo, when he did women, she thought they were fat. And I said, no, they're muscular. Okay. And again, the Renaissance artists,
mm-hmm.
before the Renaissance, all the art was like two-dimensional. It's just like faces and bodies, expression, you know, but the Renaissance artists went back to look and study the Roman and the Greeks. And the Roman and Greeks saw the human body, the human anatomy, as beautiful, as works of art. And so they got back in. So that's part of this Renaissance. Right? And that nudity is acceptable in Europe. I mean, when I was stationed in Germany along the Rhine, there was a lot of places that were nude. Okay? We would go to the swim bot, and there was areas like, okay, if you go in here, everybody's nude. It's like a nudist. Nobody thinks anything about it, okay? But if you're offended by nudity, then you can stay over here on this side. So having lived in Europe, I can see where, yeah, you know, our culture is a little bit different than theirs is in the way we look at nudity or sex or things like that. They see it as natural.
Right.
I know from the commercials in Italy, but I think that James's point, which comes out of scripture with modesty, again, getting back to the initial thing that James and I saw, I mean, the foul language and the antics that she was engaging in, or he.
Yeah, yeah.
It
made that's
me
the
blush.
In-your-face lewdness. Yeah,
yes,
I get it.
Yes.
That's
lewdness
in-your-face
is a great
lewdness.
Word.
Right.
Lewdness is a
I know,
great word.
You know, and that's in the Bible. You know,
yes,
lewd,
that's right. It's a great
conduct.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, sir.
That's a sin, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you know, when you think about the Europeans, though, it wasn't as distasteful. So, you know, it wasn't a man dressed up like a woman that was, you know, swinging, you know, playing with himself in front of kids. It would be just like you said, they're going to the beach. And, you know, and it was well marked, or the art, you know, the art.
Yeah, or
yes.
What we say, a la natural. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A la natural. Okay. They're just like, hey, we're just, you know, it's not in your face lewdness. It's no, they're sunbathing, and they're not going to have any suntan lines or whatever.
But it shocks us, because when I first saw, you know, the woman, she got up. She was, you know, on the beach, and she had something or someone putting some suntan lotion on her back, and she got up, and, you know, she wasn't covered. And so, I mean, this was in a pastor's home when I preached in Italy, in 85. And it was a regular commercial, and it was not late at night. And so I think our sensibilities, and I'm not that I don't believe that the body is beautiful, but there is a sense of modest, because scripture says the husband and wife were naked and not ashamed. And the lewd things that we're talking about and some of these, you know, ostentatious things are really just downright ugly. But I think that you're right about the Puritans, but I think that sometimes, I'll be honest with you, you know, even teaching in the university, you know, you pray that the weather gets cold because the students don't dress modestly at all. And they'll blame it on you, say, well, you know, something's in your heart. But no, you got everything in my face. You know. I'm not dead. You know what I'm saying? So I think there's some responsibility on both sides in that regard.
Well,
I wanted to
definitely
mention something real quick about some of the subversiveness. We were talking about the Ku Klux Klan and the Army. I don't know if it happened when you guys were there, but there were a lot of issues with the Masons. I remember an E-4 telling a first sergeant to shut up because he outranked him in the Masons. And so it's just interesting,
and
some of the subversiveness.
Yeah. All right.
I actually saw it.
Mm-hmm. The Masons literally controlled the NCO Corps. There was a time in the Army, like the 50s
mm-hmm.
through the 60s, that the Masons literally controlled the Army. That most of the decisions were being made in the Mason Lodge and not. In fact, when I was writing my book on the biography of General Honor, he addressed that. And in fact, my boss, who was a lieutenant colonel, grew up during that time frame, and he was worried that I was exposing that the Masons would come after me. I said, no, the Masons aren't that. They don't have that much control. And the strongest control the Masons had was in the NTO Corps, not as much. They did have a lot of influence in the officer corps, but keep in mind, the officer corps was dominated by the West Pointers, not the Masons. But the NTO Corps was heavily infiltrated by the Masons, okay? Yeah. So, yes, that was true. For people who don't, that's something that is not written about, but was well understood. 50s
yeah, we
and the 60s
we had
and
quite a lot of problems in Korea, taking over the services or having, you know, gone through the 32 steps or whatever. And I just think what James mentioned earlier, and when we talked about, you know, some of the off limit things, that we have to be careful when something taints or is subversive, not only in the military, in our families, in our nation. I think we're talking about these things that are having an adverse effect on the sanctity of the family and the breakdown of the family. You know, James mentioned crime before, and we've got to look at some of the disintegration, you know, of the family. And, you know, some of the lawlessness, and I don't know if you saw the woman who was beaten up, thrown off a bus in D.C.
Oh,
and, you know, and so I just think that there's a fifth column. There's something that's infiltrated. And just say one last thing. Today's my son's 32nd birthday. I want to say happy birthday to Michael. He's a Advent listener. He listens often to us, and you know, there's something that we have to do in the roots of, you know, the basic family structure, because something has infiltrated that's breaking up that influence, and we're paying for it in society. And so I think the building blocks are really what's important as regards the family.
You've been wanting to bring that up, and the topic of, you know, the increase in crime. You've left out, both of you left out that there's a war on cops. I mean, more and more cops are being ambushed, and the tactic now is to call in a 911, a domestic dispute, and wait for the cops to show up to kill them. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but as I thought about that, because again, we're not the experts. All we are doing is we're giving our opinions of what we are reading on the news. And unfortunately, if you're watching the TV, you're getting a very distorted view. But there's no way you can deny that crime has not gotten out of control in cities like Chicago, Milwaukee,
my cousin's
D.C.,
a cop there, and
New York City, all the places that are run by Democratic mayors and Democratic governors, it's just gone out of control, okay?
Right.
And the thing is, and here's the thing, the mayor of Chicago will challenge you that no, statistically, crime is not as bad as it used to be. It hasn't increased under her. I mean, and Biden will tell you there's no inflation. Your life is not worse economically than it is. I mean, like, are you on drugs? Okay, but anyway, I shouldn't have made that comment. But what I wanted to bring up is it's all localized. It's all localized, all right? Because you and I live in Williamsburg. Man, I'm telling you, it's like when I watch the news, all I say is, thank God I live in Virginia. Thank God I live in Williamsburg, okay? Or the peninsula. The peninsula, there is some gang shooting and stuff. But, the news, all that crime and stuff, that's going on someplace else than where you and I live. Now, I can tell you when I first moved here, in the Tidewater area, which includes Norfolk, Suffolk, Virginia Beach, Hampton Roads, Newport News, Williamsburg, Jamestown, this whole area. I mean, we have the population density of any metropolitan area. Okay. But we do not have the crime that those other areas have. Okay. Now, when I moved here, I saw on the news that they learned that Suffolk has had a the cops there tended to like shoot before they ask. Okay, there was all the problems here, like you're hearing that sparked all these riots and stuff is cops shooting black people. Well, when I moved here in 2000. It was exposed like, hey, cops are shooting a lot of people in Suffolk. They fixed it. We didn't hear about it anymore. All right. I've been called on jury duty. I've been called as witnesses. So I have had to go to court a number of times. So I'll sit there and listen to the other cases. And, you can do your jail time on the weekends. So you get arrested for something like drugs or whatever, and I watch the judges going like, okay, do you have a job, right? I'm taking your license away, all right? Suspending your license. You can only drive to work and back, and you'll do your jail time. You'll serve so much time in jail, you'll do it on the weekend. I mean, they do not want – if you're producing, if you've got a job and you're producing, the courts here do not want to ruin that. Now, when we hear about this bail reform, like in New York City, they're turning these criminals loose. Here's the deal. Yeah. So what they do is they're going like, but it's applied to people that are not a threat here in the peninsula. They're looking at it like, oh, this guy, he committed this crime. But, he has no police record. He's never done anything like that. He is not a threat. The judge will discuss this. He's not a threat to the community.
The
waiver. What they do is bail set at $1,000, we're wavering his bail so he can go. He can just be released. But the problem is, in some of these other liberal cities, they're going, no, we're releasing people that are a threat to the community.
Right.
That's the problem. The problem is not the bail reform. The problem are the people who are allowing the wrong people to get loose.
Yeah. I worked for a lawyer during college.
Go ahead.
And I used to have to do background checks. And if people were released on their own recognizances, is because they had a job, they had family, they weren't a flight threat. I used to actually sit up there with the judge. And some of them thought I was Perry Mason to shake my hand, this and that. But that's, you know, you're saying, look, you know, we know, you know, you have too many ties in the community. You're not going to go anywhere. And these weren't, you know, murderous things, although I did have some when I worked in the jail. I had a couple murders. But for lesser ones, you know, you're kind of a part of the community and, you know, we're going to work with you kind of thing. But not if I had multiple murderers.
Yeah. So what you and I are describing is all these liberal policies and liberal judgment, but used in the right context to protect the community. When the judges and the lawyers look at this case and they're going, you know, this we're protecting the community. This guy is not a threat to the community. And he is producing. We do not want to disrupt that.
Right.
Okay? You know, in the Army, there it's like, as, when you get to be a company commander, you have the authority, UMCJ, U.S. Military Justice.
UCMJ,
authority.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you can now administer punishment. All right. As a lieutenant, presumably, all you can do is take your dumbass soldier to the company commander and recommend punishment. And, but as the company commander is the one that dispenses it. All right. And the debate has always been, do you punish the offender or the offense? Correct the offense. Or, no, punish. I think it's punish the offense and correct the offender. You have to balance that. And I remember when I was lieutenant at company command getting really upset because he gave an Article 15 to a soldier he didn't like. The soldier appealed it to the battalion commander, and the battalion commander overturned it, and he was pissed. And I'm sitting there going, I don't know what you're upset about, because I have what I believe a theory of faith in fuck-ups. Okay. If this guy made a mistake and never makes that mistake, no, he beat that Article 15. And he walks on eggshells and never commits another offense. You have corrected the offense, not abused the offender. You have corrected the offense. If he never commits another crime or whatever, you have done right, even though he beat the offense. Okay. But I believe, and I found is true, that I don't care whether the guy gets away, because if he is a total screw-up, he will continue down that path. And the next time he does something wrong will be worse than the last time, okay? Which means I'm going to bust him even harder. So
can I tell a story?
Go ahead.
I want to tell a story. I used to work for a lawyer in Jersey City, New Jersey, and I worked in the local jail. And you had some people there that would really tantalize the inmates, you know, throw the sandwiches at them and take the tin cup on the bars and make noise. But I had three particular situations, and I would be there by myself, and we found a great big knife outside the window one time, and I would interview them, and I had two that were first-degree murders, 113-1 at the time. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, this person is a murderer, just murdered somebody a few hours ago. And, you know, how can I defend myself if they still have it in their blood? So I asked the occupation of this one guy, because we had one of those old typewriters. I figured I'd throw it at him or something. And he says, I'm a professional boxer. And then another guy, getting to be around our age now, Rich, who worked all his life, I remember, in this one factory for 27 years, and these guys were outside drinking, and he had a brand-new car, and I guess the bottle got away from them, and it broke on their car. He went upstairs, he got his weapon, he shot him. When the police came, he turned himself in. Then there was one other guy, I'll never forget, I saw him in court as well. He had two pairs of handcuffs on him. I'll never forget. Now, we're talking early 70s. His name was Isaiah. And, you know, he broke both. He had so much strength, he broke both of those handcuffs. Not one set, two sets. I mean, you know, we had people, you know, 300 pounds. They wanted to wrestle, and I put them off. What I'm saying is I dealt with these people. I used to give them tracks, give them gum, you know, their breath smelled like anything. But I had an opportunity, you know, to confront them as humans. But I noticed that some of the old-time cops and stuff used to agitate them, and they were looking to get into a fight. And I just think you have to treat people humanely. Now, they have to take responsibility. You know, these people, they murdered someone premeditated or whatever the situation was. But I was fortunate enough to have this encounter with them, you know, share the Lord Jesus with them as well. But I just think we want to humanize and try to mentor, you know, and help them that way.
You said the right word, humanize. Now, you have a lot more experience working with local police, okay?
Yeah.
Because you're the police chaplain. For the campus of William & Mary. Ron was a career, he retired military police, career police officer, member of our series. And so you have more experience with law enforcement in this area. So tell us about that. Are they abusive? You know, most of the problems we're seeing in these other cities is where we have cops that are out of control, that have no regard. You know, they try to paint an image of racism, but let's just face it. There is a culture in the inner city blacks to resist arrests. I've heard that from a number of police officers because I trained in Aikido for 26 years when I was in Florida. The dojo I belonged to was founded by a deputy sheriff, and so we had a lot of cops, and they were telling me the stories. You go, and you can ask any cop. You go and just, they can tell you where the neighborhoods are that there are the problems. Okay, all right. Yep. And
but you bring
that there is a
very
culture
good point
of resisting arrest.
I made a note earlier when you said that you know it was different in Virginia. And I put why with several question marks.
And that's what I want to hear.
Since
you work with the police officers, let's talk.
Yep.
See,
yep.
We got it right. This is what I'm trying to say. In those other cities, we've seen what wrong looks like. But over here in the Tidewater area, we don't have those problems. And I think we have, so tell us. What are we doing right?
Even my cousin, who's a police officer in Chicago, when he tries to do community policing, that's what we have right. You're there to serve and protect. You're there to empower. Somebody needs a ride. They're walking down the street. It's cold. In other words, you're not antagonistic. It's not us and them. You're the bad gang. We're the good gang. And I just think the personal relationship. Now, there are some really bad people. You need to treat them with dignity, but you need to have the wherewithal, like you and I have said, to pull them down, to do what you need to do to apprehend them. And you and I have talked extensively also. I know who you are. I have your license. You're in this community. And I think the real issue is community policing. And see, when I wrote my book, I did some study with the Scotland Yard. And see, here it's always, get on the ground, get on the ground. and we escalate rather than de-escalate.
Police officers are trained to escalate the situation in America.
Right. You're right.
But in Europe, they're not.
That's right.
They're trained to de-escalate the threat.
That's right.
But in America, they're trained to start yelling at you from the beginning.
And
but they
we
don't.
Would both agree.
Look, all my encounters, police officers, have all been polite here in the here in the peninsula. Tell us about your encounter. You know what you know about the police training, the police officers, their attitude, and all that.
Yeah, I know a lot of them. I mean, I know the sheriff in our community.
No,
personally.
I know. I want you to tell.
Yeah.
So
I've lauded your credibility
that you know these guys. So we know what wrong looks like, George Floyd. Tell me what right looks like. Why are we getting it right here?
Again, it goes back to community policing. It goes back to relationship. You know, there's not this.
Give us examples.
Kind of
Give us examples, okay?
Well, like with the paramilitary, like, you know, we know that some people are really trained, and I don't know if James was on a SWAT team, but who are really trained, and when you need that one shot, one kill. But for the most part, you're there to be a good presence. You're there to be friendly. You're there to, you know, you live in the community. My cousin has to live in Chicago, even though they live where most of the police and firemen and firewomen are. But I just think it's humanizing. It's just, you know, treating people respectfully and getting
to
know them.
With dignity. That's what I find with our police here in this part of Virginia. They treat everybody with dignity. They do not escalate the situation. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I had two situations where I was – we had a former member in the church, you might have remembered. She was a professor at William & Mary. And so she was also teaching at George Mason, and she asked me to watch her house. And I didn't know where it was. And I made a turn on Reg, and the state trooper stopped me. And I could see he was a first sergeant. And he goes, you know, I can't even do that. And I explained who I was. I just worked out.
And he gets the map out. You know, I enjoy talking with him. I don't always come to a complete stop a stop sign.
But I mean,
whatever.
He took a
and
map
I get
out,
pulled
he
over,
showed me.
And the cop got up and he's walking by and he comes up there and he takes his knuckles and he wraps my trunk and then he comes over and asks my vehicle ID and registration and stuff like that. And, you know, here's the thing. My grandfather was a police officer, so I always treat every police officer with respect, okay? And he takes it, and like, of course, you're going like, do you know what I pulled you over for?
Right.
Of course, I had to admit it. And he's like, you know, and the thing is, if you confess it and you're polite to them, most of the time, they're going to let you go. You want to know why? Because if they write you up for a ticket, they have to appear in court.
Right. Right. Some of the younger ones.
You can pay it or you can show up in court. I actually had one guy, you know, he pulled me over because the speed limit, you know, what is it? I'm trying to remember, 144 or whatever, coming from, you know, Newport News to Williamsburg. And it goes from, I forgot what, 55 to like 45. Okay, it's right under the underpass, and I missed it, and I didn't slow down. I got pulled over, and the guy comes over, and he's talking to me. He's like, you know, see, evidently, after 10 years, all your traffic violations get deleted. He's look, you haven't had a traffic ticket in 10 years. He said, he's writing me up. He said, but I'll tell you what. He said, you show up in court, and they will probably reduce. I'll have to pay the court cost. But he said it'll be cheaper than paying the fine. So I took the court. they come
I've
up
had
there.
All kinds of things, like, you know,
yeah.
coming back to me and say, no, I decided not to give it to you. Had that happen twice.
Most of the, I'm telling
also,
you, most
when
of
I was
the
at
time,
Hampton, let me say a funny
most
story.
Most of the time, police officers,
the guy
just,
gets
we
out.
Have a polite conversation
right.
and let me go.
That's right. But the guy saw I was a priest, and he was an African-American state trooper. And he said, oh,
yeah.
Father, I'm so sorry. And then what I did is I went into the lane before, because you know how the bridge gets backed up? Well, I went into the
yeah.
lane because I don't want to be late for class when I was teaching at Hampton University.
Right.
But, I mean, he was like, oh, Father, I'm so sorry. I said I did wrong, you know. And so, really, it's just treating people, you know, you
right.
make mistakes.
Right, with dignity, no. with dignity.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right.
That's,
that's
it.
Right.
That's right.
Now yeah. James has had some encounters as a police officer. James, would your experience be any different in the community you worked in?
Well, you know, dealing with the general population, I'll tell you, there's you run into different people. You know, I know my son yeah. recently, but, you know, at that time, people had a profound level of respect for you know, people in uniform, and there were some things went on. And I'll just tell you, there were some bad things that went on. Some police officers really didn't need to be police officers, you know, but for the most
right.
part, it was a fairly good experience. And there was good interaction. Now it's, you know, it's a whole different game. You know, it's, you know, everybody's looking for 30, you know, 15 seconds of fame on YouTube. You know, there isn't the civil discussions like there used to be. It's the windows are up. Over for. I'm not going to show you my license. And,
right.
You know, I don't listen to anything you say. And, you know, I don't think I could be a police officer today. I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Not in this current mm-hmm. administration, in this current, you know, what's going on all across America. So, yeah. But interesting.
No. I'm telling you right now, you couldn't be a police officer. You wouldn't want to be a police officer in Chicago, New York City, or places like that. But being a police officer in Williamsburg, Yorktown, Jamestown, Newport News, Norfolk, or whatever, that's where you wouldn't want to be, okay? Because I'm telling you, we do not have the problems you're seeing on the news.
Yeah.
Even Joseph, who we had as a guest, was a captain.
Right.
And he tells
me
about...
He used to be a police officer here.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a committee captain. Then he was a chief down in Mississippi. Yeah. Yeah. And he shares, you know, some of the instances that they had, like, you know, a 500 group, you know, of people, you know, surrounding the whole thing. But, you know, how it was able to be settled down and negotiated, and a lot of it, you know, had to do with, you know, interacting with people, and you keep saying the right word, Rich, with dignity, and even if there's a misunderstanding. And I think I've come across some younger guys or some people who are trying to prove something, and I've sat on boards where we disqualified or not hired someone because we picked up some character flaws. And so
mm-hmm.
I think what you were saying, James, is very important that we need to not everybody can do that job, not just because you have the physical fitness to do it. There's a
yeah.
lot of psychological, yeah, yeah, and control and, you know, keeping your military
yeah,
bearing.
Yeah, it's you know, there's a tremendous amount, you know, you learn a lot of patience, that's for sure, when dealing with people. And, you know, people are just, they're different now. I mean, it's kind of shocking. You know, I mean, man, I deal with it even with doing this job with the museum. I deal with people all the time. And for the most part, 98% of the people are really good. But every mm-hmm. now and then, you know, you get that one.
I don't know. You know, here's the thing. There's, all right. I'm from Oklahoma, so we're actually that's Southwest. I always considered myself Midwest, Southwest, and so moving to Virginia, the culture I came from is very similar to Southern culture, and it's about politeness. politeness.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Everybody called it, you know, you call elderly people sir, you call elderly women ma'am, okay? I get called sir a lot, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I'm, you know, it's easier. Like, hey, sir, you left your bag here, sir, ma'am, okay? The politeness of this community is incredible, okay? And, you know, like, it doesn't matter what your race is. And I remember one time I was driving the van and it died on me. Man, the people like pulling over to help me. Hey, what do you need? What do you need? And, you know, I don't like thinking in terms, you know, I don't like to, well, this person was black or this person was Asian. I really hate that because it was a person. Mm-hmm. But the thing
you're
is,
right.
Race had nothing to do with helping somebody else, all right? But people here in the South, people were eager to stop and help me out, give me a charge. I was
you know what's
shocked
interesting about
at how
that,
many
Rich?
People were pulling over to help me.
My neighborhood here been more integrated than they were in the North. They were more segregated.
Yeah.
And yet the North kind of tries to say that, you know, they're really for the rights
of
the minority.
Let me explain this. It's
a
friend that
so.
Told me this. In the North, they love the race. In the South, they love the individual.
They love the people. Yeah.
And I had a friend tell me this. He said, we went up to Boston or whatever. He said, you're not going to see black people in a white restaurant. All right. Yeah. So in the South, they hate the race, but they love the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In the South, you know, like white people have black friends. They may be racist. This is early South. They may be racist, but everybody grew up, you know, with a black friend. All right, which is weird about it. Okay, if you realize this person is a good person, why you're friends with them, personal friends with them, and why do you think the race is bad? But up North, you say, yeah, we like the black race. Look, there's states in New England that don't have black people. They don't know how to deal with them, okay? And you're going, oh, yeah, we're not racist. How many black friends do you have?
But
now,
again,
I take joy. I
would
just say, I take offense. If someone asked me that question, I'd be pissed off because my friends are my friends. I don't look at them as to what the race is. Anyway.
Well, when I was at Harvard,
so
I felt that
that's my comment
same
on
thing.
Yours.
Yeah. You know, love the race. I looked around at Harvard. I said, well, where's the diversity?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
My neighborhoods down here have been much more integrated, okay, than in the North. So you're absolutely right with that assessment.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I think, James, I think we beat this subject. It's not the direction you probably wanted to go because we don't have the experience with what's going on in these big cities run by Democratic mayors. We just know here in Virginia, all right, oh, and keep in mind, you can't get a look for my district. I don't think you can get elected to Congress if you're not a veteran. Because every runoff is between a veteran. You know, I don't even remember when I had a congressional representative who was not a veteran, okay? So anyway, what's the next topic?
Oh, that's great. And good jump off point. We got about 50 minutes left. And we want to talk about the veterans, in particular, to traumatic brain. I think it's important to understand the CHOICE program was designed to live far away from the VA, you know, from healthcare facility. Which meant that, you know, you could find a doctor, if they could VA approved, you could see them for all your disabilities. No longer would you have to make, and in some cases, could not pay at all. You know, they sent me to a chiropractor doctor and a massage therapist at one point. And it was, I loved the therapy. And I remember that woman saying, look, I can't see you anymore because, and this was after 6 months, she has not paid me anything. I had insurance, you know, that would have paid for that. No personal insurance. But because the service occurred under the choice program, I couldn't even, what I could pay that doctor was to write her a personal check. Thousands of dollars, you know, it was just a sad situation. So anyways, that's what the choice product is about. I'd like to talk about that. And ask Joe if we could, the last, 10, 20 minutes, anyways, I really want to touch on traumatic brain injury. You know, this is brain injury radio. And what's going on with the VA, the fact that it's not the VA. But we only have about 10% of the doctors in America even treat TBI. And there are programs shown, you know, quality of life with treatment that the VA won't pay for, and that civilian, there are these chambers you go into, you just, you know, massive amount of oxygen that they put into your system. So you breathe it in, this chicken, breathe it in, it gets into your brain cells, and it's supposed to heal. I don't know if I've ever been in one. Let's talk choice program. Father Michael, what do you know about the choice program, and tell us about your experience with the VA?
Yeah, you know, I'm putting in because of the cancer, because I was recognized, have been exposed to Agent Orange when I got hit with the diabetes 3 years ago. So I have to get some examinations, you know, they have to verify. But I was told the other day that you probably have to travel 100 miles if possible. So, Rich, I'm certainly going to ask you to go with me. And, you know, for the day trip. I don't understand that in light of the bus trips and the plane trips that the illegal aliens are getting and the phones, and it's like they're cutting back. But I don't know much about the choice, but I've had a mixed bag experience. You know, I got out in 72 the first time, 2004, even though I served in 2005. And it hasn't always been consistent. So maybe you can explain about the choice program, because I don't know what it is. I just know I'm 40% disabled, and, you know, they've helped me some. But now the bills are piling up from all the cancer stuff, and I'm still, you know, following it up. So maybe I'll learn something that could help me here, too.
How about you, Rich? Do you know much about the choice program and your experience with the VA healthcare system?
Well, here's the problem. I'm pretty damn healthy, okay? Look, I'm drawing disability for my injured back, but I go to a chiropractor and a civilian chiropractor. And the VA, I probably see him. Look, there was a period of time where I was seeing him once a month. And the VA, all I had to do was send in, here's my bill, and they would pay it, because they don't have chiropractors in the VA. No. And then, but now I'm like every 3 or 4 months I go to this guy. And the other injury, the other thing that I've drawn disability for is my hearing. And I have yet to go in for a hearing aid. I know I've been told that the VA will provide me the state-of-the-art hearing aid.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when I teach college, you know, my students probably wish I would go in for it, but I have to remind them, you got to speak up, okay? And the burden's on you. I want to hear what you have to say. You got to speak up. So I really don't, other than that, I don't have a whole lot of experience with the VA. All my experience is very positive, okay? So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine, and that's good to hear that you had a you had a positive experience. But across the nation,
I don't go into the yeah. VA hospital. I mean, the biggest thing was
how
going in and getting my disabled veterans card so I can go shop in the PX and the conference area. That's it.
Right.
That's the most time I've spent in the VA hospital was doing that. Oh. And the only reason I went in and even applied for disability is because my brother worked in a VA hospital in Muskogee, Oklahoma. And he told me, he said, Rick, they call me Richard. Family calls me Richard. Friends call me Rich. And he's like, look, he told me, he said, you got to go in. You know, I told him what my injuries were. He said, you got to go in and get it. Registered, he said.
Right.
He said, all right, and this is the funny part. So most of my injuries is back related. And so when I walked into the, because he told me I sent the application in, and a year and a half later, I get called in for my review. Okay, the surgeon is going to review a year and a half later. Okay, and I walk in there and it's hearing and back injuries, two back injuries. Right, and they found my military records that documented the two injuries, and the date. So the surgeon is there and she says, bend over and touch the floor. And I bend over and I touch the floor with my hand, and she dropped her pen. Now, she doesn't look at me, but she starts talking about how veterans with these service-connected injuries keep coming in and applying for disabilities so they can get the check. I looked at her and said, you want to know why I'm here? Because my brother works for a VA hospital. He told me if I wait until I need the disability,
right,
the process is so slow, it'll be too late. And she's like, yeah, you're right. And she says, look to the left. She starts telling me, like, look to the left, look to your right, rotating my neck and all this stuff. She's not even looking at me. I told her, I said, the reason was, I said, I don't want to sit here and come in with a neck brace and act like I'm injured and crippled to get the disability. I said, no, I have complete flexibility. I live with pain. It feels like someone's stabbing me with a damn ice pick in my neck, okay? But I live with this pain, but I have full flexibility, and here's the reason why. Because I go to a chiropractor once a month, and two, I do Aikido. So I don't want someone coming up there and taking pictures of me rolling around on a mat and going, hey, look, right, this guy claims to be disabled, and he's not. And I'm like, because that's one of the things they. And I said, look, I have full flexibility. And in reality, the rolling on the mat is probably what helps keep me flexible. Okay. And, but anyway, no, I got my disability. I got my disability for that. Yeah, but
my
brother was.
Also, I had an accident in physical training. And so everything was documented. And even when I went to England, I have to say, this is positive. They gave me a certificate, even though when you go to school over there, you right away get medical health benefits.
All right.
But
I'm going
to
tell you one thing.
Help.
All right. I'm going to tell you one thing. And the look, for any disabled veterans out there, you need to go to the DAV. Before you go to the VA hospital, you need to go to the Disabled American Veterans Organization, because they know the rules. Okay.
Yes.
Now, when I went in, and it was one of those guys that told me why I got my disability, because I told him if I'd known that, I should have, when I was in Oklahoma, I should have applied for VA. So they would, because I wasn't making that much, and they would have paid for my chiropractor visits. I mean, I only went to the chiropractor when I was really hurting bad. And the VA rep said you wouldn't have got it. He said, because there's two things you have to show. First, you have to prove a service-connected injury. And then you have to show a history of treatment. He said, the fact you had this back pain or neck pain and you went into a chiropractor, you had no history of treatment. He said, the guy told me, he said, the reason you got your, they awarded you disability was because you'd been going to a chiropractor for 3 years before you went into the VA.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I got it. Document the two injuries that led to my, you know, upper vertebrae and my lower vertebrae, okay? But it's the fact that I've been going to a chiropractor on my own money for 2 or 3 years is what got me in. So for if there's any lesson out there for any disabled veterans out there who haven't applied for VA benefit, go to the DAV. And here was here's another thing they did. So I'm like, okay, I got this. My left knee hurts. Now, since then, I've taken glucosamine, and it doesn't hurt. I can run. But it was at the point I couldn't run on pavement anymore. And I listed that, but there's no service-connected injury there. And someone told me.
Well, the run.
If you had 2 years on jump status,
yeah.
Jump status for non-airborne people is you jumped out of, you were jumping out of airplanes for two years. You qualified for back and knee injury, okay?
Sure.
Yeah. So if I said, they said we have no proof, we're going, the VA's like, okay, you're complaining about your left knee hurting when you walk and stuff like that and run. Yeah, we have no service connected injury. If I'd told them I'd been on jump status for 3 years, I would have qualified for that one. So for those out there, go to the DAV. They're, that whole organization, I've been fortunate because my brother was a VA rep and he advised me. And the thing is, and I'm healthy. All right. I don't want to take advantage of the system. Right. So I have my ID card, I can go shop at the PX and the Compass area, and I can get my liquor, like no taxes from the class. It used to be the Class 6 store, now it's the PX Express. But anyway, so if you have a service-connected injury and you want to apply for your military disability, go to the DAV. They know what you have to do.
I had someone come to my house. Her husband retired from the Army and, got a hold of my medical records and, submitted the actual thing. And I heard like a week later, now this is a minor appointment, but then there's going to be a major, see whether it's service connected. It's funny, when I went the first time, I have a back and also diabetes. The guy says to me, well, Chaplain, were you a killer? I said, no. I told him what I did and where I was and stuff like that. I said, well, a lot of chaplains that I have are killers, he goes. And I don't know if he's the decision maker, but it was really an interesting thing going there. And now I'm going to go through a whole lot of other examinations before they determine and make a determination if this is connected as well. But in the meantime, and I've talked to the VA, you're absolutely right with that DAV, because I've done that, that if they do recognize it, then they'll be there for you. And the thing that I learned, and I was doing some virtual visits, because if you lose your contact with the VA hospital, if and when you're older and you really need it, it's not going to be there, and you'll have to go through a whole process. So I've even told my son, at least get registered like you're telling us, Rick. So at least
no,
you
that's
have a
exact, that's exactly what my brother told me and every other
yeah.
veteran has told me. If you have a service-connected injury, stuff like that, go get it registered, okay?
Right.
Because they can always upgrade it. But you've got to go
right.
in and get it. Because if you wait, that's what my brother said, working in VA hospital. If you wait, the process is so slow. A year and a half. Look, I was surprised when they got the letter to come in for
yeah.
the review or whatever. But if you wait until you need the treatment, you're going to die. You're going to die
right.
waiting for it. Oh, and you know, guess what? For all you liberals out there who want socialized medicine, look at the VA.
Yeah.
You're
yeah,
going to die.
Really.
You're going to die, okay?
Now, President Trump had done something. I have a temporary card, and I was able to go on the economy. Now the VA has worked it out for me. For the diabetes to go on the economy, but it's, thank God, it's so much under control that he had me take a blood test. I don't want to see it for 6 months. So it gives them very little, you know, to have to do to go all the way to Hampton. You know, the doctor's right in Toano over here. And so I'm hoping with this other situation that I won't have to travel, you know, to New Jersey or Maryland or something. Just to verify it, because James had told us some time ago that they were shutting down. And I understand even on the peninsula where we have so many veterans, they're going to be shutting down some of these facilities. And for special things that we have to get examined for, if they don't have that specialty in your area, she told me you're going to have to drive up to 100 miles.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm friends with a person whose husband works at the Hampton VA Center. And she explained to me the reason they're closing down the Hampton VA Center is because it's like 150 years old, okay?
Man, it
like,
ate up. I
look,
on there.
The Virginia, like the Virginia, the whole Tidewater area, we have the largest concentration of military bases. We have several naval bases, several military bases, okay? We have Coast Guard. We have the CIA. What we don't have we have an Air Force base. We have Langley. But we don't have, we have NASA. But we don't have a Marine Corps base, okay? That's the only thing we're missing. This is the highest concentration of military bases in the continental United States. We have probably the largest concentration of veterans and military retirees. There, why would you close down our VA? Because he told me it's 150 years old. Okay, it's too old. It's not cost effective. Okay, so unfortunately, we may have to drive a distance to. Or they're going to have to refer us to local doctors. But anyway, that's the reason they're closing down the Hampton VA hospital.
Yeah. So, James, could you inform us a little bit about that choice program? Because we're both not really informed about it. Because James was asking us whether we knew about the choice program. And, you know, I know there are a lot of benefits. I mean, when I had to do my doctorate, one of my students told me about the post 9/11 money. And when I called the VA, they told me about all this money that I had on hand that I never knew about. I'm grateful I didn't use it for Yale and Harvard because I forfeited it, and then they offered to pay 70%. But nobody told me. And I think that for us veterans, there's a lot of benefits. And it's difficult for us here because we have so many veterans, but we're not totally informed.
Yeah, that's why I'd say you got to go to your DAV, all right? Fortunately for me, all right, there's a lot of benefits because now that I'm a disabled vet, I think they're going to pay for it. You know, look, I was cheated out of my GI Bill. I earned my GI Bill as an enlisted man during the Vietnam War, but I went to West Point. And so when I got out of the Army, you know, they had the Montgomery GI Bill where you had to invest in it. Okay. So I got out of the Army, 1990, right before Desert Storm, and I go in and apply for the GI Bill. And they look, I have two DD-214s. One as an enlisted man. I have a discharge as enlisted man. I have a discharge as an officer. And the guy goes and looks it up. The guy looked it up. He says, you don't qualify for the GI Bill. I said, what do you mean? He said, because it says here, anybody who attended West Point after, who graduated from West Point after like 1977 or 78, 77, does not qualify for the GI Bill. I said, but I qualified for it because I was in the Army. I enlisted in the Army in 1973. He said, but it shows here, you don't qualify because you graduated from West Point in 79. I said, I think the key word you're looking for is disqualified. It doesn't say, yes, I don't qualify for the GI Bill because I graduated. I became an officer in 1979. I qualified for the GI Bill because I enlisted in the Army during the Vietnam War. The word you're looking for is disqualified. Guess what? I did not get my GI Bill. Here's the problem with the VA. Funding. When funding gets tight, they're going to look for ways to husband it. Yep. You're going to get screwed, and if it comes to health, you're going to die.
When I went to college, not only did I have my Montgomery, whatever it was back then, but because my father was 100% disabled, I also was able to use some of his.
Right, and, but you benefited. Yeah. You benefited because you came back on active duty, and then the war in Iraq broke out, and then they come up with a new policy that you can pass your GI Bill down to your children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's how you were able to get your doctorate. Now, in my case, because the only reason I brought it up, because I got screwed out of my GI Bill. I had to pay for my master's degree.
Right.
But
because
I'm a disabled vet, I understand that they will pay for continuing education. So I could possibly go for my PhD. But I don't want to go for my PhD, okay? It's not worth it, okay? I don't want to spend a lot of time writing papers for someone where I can actually write papers that become articles that get published, or books, write a dissertation for some professor when I can write a book and get paid for it.
C.S.
That's
Lewis
my issue.
Has the same sentiment. But I told you in a meeting the other day.
Wait. I like C.S. Lewis. I watched the movie about it.
Yes.
What do you mean he had the same sentiment? Tell me about that.
He said the same thing. He said, why should I write a PhD where one person will read it when I can write all these books that everybody can benefit from?
Wait a minute.
C.S. Lewis was a professor
at one of the prestigious
Oxford and Cambridge.
English college, right. So he did get the PhD, right?
No, he did not.
He didn't?
He wrote, Reinhold Niebuhr is another one, and he taught at Union.
Oh, my God.
And
okay, so I have a new hero. I have a new hero. So you're telling me C.S. Lewis refused to get his PhD because he read rather write a book that people are going to read than write a dissertation that only one person will read.
That's correct. Another friend of mine.
Thank you.
He's an Oxford.
I'm now going to cite that.
Good. No, it's true. There's another Oxford philosopher named Richard Swinburne. Before I got my doctorate, he's a very famous philosopher. I went up to him and I said, I don't have a PhD. He says, neither do I. Now, this guy taught at Oxford, I think, 35 years or whatever. But he said to me finally, so I'm glad you're reading for your PhD. He encouraged me. you know, while I was doing it. There are some people, Rich, that are brilliant, and I know another guy who was considered for a job at Cambridge, and he didn't have a PhD, but because he had written books, and he was an architecture major, so it was about light and all this other stuff. And I was told one other time at Harvard, before I had my PhD, my professor who I had there said, I would consider you for the job. The only difference, you don't have a book like this other guy. I didn't have the, you know, the writing.
All right. I want to state something, though. I want to state something. When it comes to universities, it's not just having a book published, but it has to be a book published that went through the peer review, the scholarly review.
That's right.
So getting – you can have a best-selling book out there, but if it did not go through the peer review, it doesn't count, okay?
You're right. My dissertation went through peer review, and no, you're absolutely right. And now I'm conducting a peer review workshop, and it's very difficult for the students to come under that scrutiny. And I went over a paper that I did that I presented – at Cambridge in the Westcott House, 2009, and I showed them the whole thing. They loved it, like what you have to propose before, you can have an acceptance of what you're doing because it contributes to what's already been written about it and stuff like that. But absolutely.
For the lay audience, when they say peer review is – mm-hmm. Other scholars have looked at your work and said,
right.
One, it's accurate, and two, mm-hmm. It is scholarly. It benefits society. Whereas a publisher, like my Filthy 13, he's only asking the question, will it sell?
Right.
Now, actually, I will tell you, when I submitted the Filthy 13 to Casemate, he's like, this story is unbelievable. You know, so he sends it to the one guy. When we say peer review, there's three, usually in a peer review process, there are three scholars on your subject that have to review, and all three have to agree. This is a book that needs to be published. Okay. But in this guy's case, he's like, it's really hard to believe this story's true. So he sends it to the one guy who could confirm it, and I know that guy. And he goes, yeah, no, this is a true story. He's not making this one up, okay? This is true. It's more. And, in fact, Mark Bando, who did the review, who confirmed that the Filthy 13 story was true, and he had only mentioned it a little bit in one of his books on the 101st, okay?
Do you know what imprimatur is?
No, I don't.
In most Catholic books, you'll see nihil obstat, which shows that there's no errors, and imprimatur, it's usually by a bishop, will say that it's orthodox, you know, that it's sound. And so it's the same kind of validation.
Right.
When
we're talking about the concept, all right, there's, in publishing, it's what will sell. For most commercial publishers, it's what will sell. And for the scholarly presses, it has to be reviewed by scholars to confirm two things. One, it is a scholarly, and it contributes to our academic knowledge.
Absolutely. Did we lose James? Does he want to?
I don't know, James. You out there?
Yep. Oh yeah, I'm still here. I'm listening.
Great.
Yeah, we got 19 minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about traumatic brain injury and how it it is. It's you know they call it the signature wound of this current war. The war in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, that, you know, it's shocking just how many people have come back with a traumatic brain injury. And what's even more shocking is, you know, we see these high suicide rates because, you know, they're really tracking it now. But you're also seeing this you know, this, how the people with a traumatic brain injury are three times more likely to commit suicide, which I was shocked when I seen that. And then you look at the shortage of doctors that even exist in America, let alone the VA, because the VA has none. You know, they don't have specific doctors that are, you know, genuinely focused on, you know, a treating of a mild traumatic brain injury or a traumatic brain injury in general. And that was shocking. And you see all this stuff, all this, you know, the recent passing of the PAC Act. And, you know, that was a great bill. Glad that it passed. But, you know, some of us wanted to add the traumatic brain injury so that it would be, you know, there would be a series of funding that would be directly related to research and research and development. So, first off, Rich, I would say that you probably have a traumatic brain injury with all the boxing and stuff that you have done.
No. And the symptom of that is memory loss, okay? I can't remember more than six or seven numbers at a time, okay? And especially in the interview when I, especially when I'm transcribing, I can tell you where I literally see the memory loss on things, and that is, so I'm transcribing an interview, can only remember so many words of a sentence. So it takes me, like Barbara Bauer, she could like listen to a sentence and type the whole thing out. I can only listen to, like, remember like so many words and type it out. I have a really limited number of memory. Okay. So that's the consequences of my, boxing experience. Okay. Both at West Point, and I continued to box. I was stupid. I was a lieutenant in the Army, and I'm sitting there going, I miss being in the ring, and I went into a smoker. I came out of the field. I only had 2 weeks to train for the fight, and I was a technical. The guy didn't knock me out. He didn't put me on the ground, but I'm telling you, the lights were on, but no one was home. Okay, the ref looked at my eyes. He waved me off. He said, this guy ain't here anymore. This fight's over. Okay. And I suffered amnesia from it. I was able to remember what happened. I understood that, look, people get knocked out in a fight. They suffer amnesia. And the thing is like, how far does that amnesia go? Most guys who get knocked out don't even remember getting knocked out. So you stand there and talking to the guy the next day. He's like, I went to a guy. When I hit him, people watching that fight said his feet went a foot, 10 inches to a foot off the ground. And he bounced hit the ropes and then bounced back. And I met him the next day, and he's talking about how close he came to beating me. You don't even remember how I beat you, okay? And the thing is, I've been told this. Like, some people say, you know, I was talking to one person. He said that the amnesia you suffer from a knockout could go back 15 minutes. Like, one guy recovered. He says, like, Coach, when am I going to fight? He's like, remember, you've already lost. Okay.
Wow.
So that's the immediate TBI in fighting, but the long term is, I suffer memory loss. Okay, I don't need to go into it much more. So yes, I suffer TBI from boxing in the Army.
Yep. Well, and the interesting thing is why so few doctors? Because, you know, this isn't something that's new. You know, there's been concussion injuries for forever. You know, it wasn't.
All right, James, I'm going to answer your question beforehand. Why is it important? Why did any doctor need to pay attention to me getting knocked out in a fight? Okay, why?
Right. Before we get it, all right. So the thing is with TBI is a big thing because of the IED attacks. But before that, what was traumatic brain injury, TBI? Who suffered that? Boxers? They voluntarily went into it. We used to call it, like look at Muhammad Ali in his old age. We had a term for that. It was called punch drunk. Okay?
Yeah.
All those nerds, guys, all those old boxers that are slurring their speech, they were called punch. No one was studying it. No one paid attention to it until this recent war. They came up, and so they came up with a new term for it. Instead of punch drunk, they called it TBI, traumatic brain injury. Okay,
right.
And I'll tell you. All right, I'm gonna give you a funny story. So I traveled the Southwest Asia area five times Iraq, two times Afghanistan. I rode on convoys. And I collected convoy stories. And there was this one guy. He had had so many IEDs go off on him that they called, oh, God, Mushy Head. They called him Mushy Head. Mushy Head. Because it was, and the doctors were studying like, hey, look, you hit your limit. You can't go out on the road anymore, okay? So he was all upset because, you've had too many TBIs. Any more than this, you're going to suffer permanent brain damage. So the joke is everybody called him Mushy Head after that. But until this recent war, doctors weren't studying it. Okay? Actually, I watched a movie about it. No. The biggest TBI thing is football, where they're literally colliding head to head and causing serious brain injury that caused people to commit suicide. Old football players to commit suicide years later. Okay? So yeah, the interest in this whole concept of traumatic brain injury is a recent study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it comes from the football. No one paid attention to boxers. They just called us punch drunk. It was a common thing. Because not that many of us were punch drunk, okay? But it was football players and then this recent war. Yes.
I knew somebody who had sparred or fought with Archie Moore. This is way back. And he had been quite wealthy at one time. And you talk about punch drunk. I mean, everything you said, Rich, about slurred speech and just, he took a lot of hits to the head. And,
look up any video of Muhammad Ali in his old age. That's what we'd all call, okay? No one understood it. No one cared to understand it because it was limited to boxers.
But with the new helmets, when I went to Fort Knox a couple of years ago, they said that they were consulting with the NFL. Now, they had new Kevlars. I tried it on. It's totally different than, when we were there. So I think they're kind of...
No, I'm going to tell you, the new Kevlar wasn't designed with TBI intent. It was designed because of the headphones we had to wear. Because I was wearing the old Kevlar, and it wasn't designed for these massive headphones, so I could talk to the crew members, and it was really pressing on my head. The new Kevlar, the Paz G, and there's two that came out. The Paz G had more room. It had nothing to do with TBI.
Okay. I wanted, before we go and I say a prayer, I just want to make a special announcement because I have a special event at church on Sunday. Certainly want to finish with the thought here. But, it's a very serious thing, and I I just don't think that the VA is really cognizant of how much suffering is going on and how little attention is being given to these things. And I don't think the present administration
really cares about that. I'm going to challenge you on
that.
All right. We had Dana on this show, and she, of course, would slam the VA. My experience with the VA is these are caring professionals. Now, my brother's experience in the Muskogee VA hospital is, no, it was toxic. It was toxic. Okay? And keep in mind, you know, like James pointed it out, if you're a surgeon and you want to make more, there's a really good movie called Purple Hearts. Watch it. Okay? Now, the thing is, go ahead.
Let me just say it. When I went to Hampton, all these guys, because I was in my clerics, they said, Chaplain, they make us wait and wait. They don't tell us, you know, how long the wait's going to be. And I told you, I wrote a complaint on their behalf.
It's beer charge.
At least.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you want to know what it's like to work in, to go to the VA hospital, think of going to the DMV, okay? Anything run by the government, bureaucracy, is not about helping people.
Even Ron, as a sergeant major, retired, he was shocked because he was going with TRICARE. He didn't really go, but he came with me one time. He was shocked at what he saw.
Right. Okay. Anyway, so your point, what was your
lead? My point is that it's not servicing the veterans. You know, they always say when you talk to them, thank you for your service, but it's like, how about giving me some service now?
It's all about cost. I'm going to tell you right now.
Yes, it's all about cost.
It's all about cost. Talking about government provided health care. When the money, look, why did I qualify for the GI Bill as enlisted man? And the guy looked at my, I had two discharges. The first discharge qualified for the GI Bill, but the second discharge didn't. It didn't disqualify me for it. It didn't qualify me for it. So the guy looked at it and says, you're not qualified for the GI Bill. Completely disregards the other one. Why? Because it comes down to money. Money.
And, but they're also
when the
not
government
real
gets involved in health care, try to save money.
Yeah.
That's the problem with the VA.
Yeah, but also, I no offense, because they're wonderful people, and you said committed people. But I'm afraid that you know, it's just like you were talking about with the lieutenant and the captain with adjudication or with the commander. I had to get on my soldiers because they were so inconsistent in the way they interpreted the policies and procedures and the UCMJ. And I think here, too, you get different answers for so many different things, and I'm not sure you have the highest quality people that are taking care of us veterans.
Yeah, and, you know, and when I said the movie Purple Hearts, because there's a guy who is, he goes into the Navy as a surgeon because in Vietnam, and they said 1 year as a surgeon in Vietnam is equal to multiple years of practice in another surgery. All right. So he comes, you know, so a lot of surgeons were doing that to get this experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could market that when they come home.
Absolutely.
The thing is, he comes back and he applies for a VA, worked at a VA hospital. And it's interesting because the person interviewing says, you know, like, why are you applying for us? Now, you gotta watch this story. He falls in love with a nurse, and she wants to work at a VA hospital and stuff like that. And that's the reason why. And he thinks he gets killed in a mortar attack. And so
here he is. He goes to Vietnam to get all this medical experience. So he'd come back and make a lot of money. But instead, he's sitting there, and the surgeon, the head surgeon at this VA hospital is like, why are you applying for us? Man, you could go into any hospital and make more. And I don't think he explains it well. But for the happy ending is, it turns out the nurse he fell in love with in Vietnam, turns out she lived, she survived that mortar attack, and she was working at the hospital that he applies for. Purple Heart, great movie, great movie.
Yeah, I wrote it down. I would like to mention something before I pray, and that is I have a young priest and a young deacon coming to my parish mission on Sunday from Maryland, and I want to extend an invitation to all. We're at 1166 Jamestown Road, Williamsburg, Virginia, 23185. It's at 10:30, and St. Michael and All Angels. And it should be a wonderful time. We're going to have several guests, and I just want to extend that before I pray.
But, all right, tell people, to anybody, look, I'm going to tell you right now. All right. I was raised Baptist and Pentecostal, but I met Father Michael. He wasn't Father Michael. He was Chaplain Pacella.
That's right.
We instantly became friends, okay, because of our, like, Pacella, he watched me walk around during a officer professional development class, and he's like, he comes up and asks me, like, are you a martial artist? Because he could tell by the way I walk. And we instantly became friends, and we've been friends ever since. For 22 years, we've been friends. And when he was called to leave the military and become a chaplain, he converted to Charismatic Episcopalian Church, and I've been a member of his congregation since then. All right, but I just want to tell you, all right, why? Look, for me, when I sit in a look, my wife's Catholic. I go to the Catholic church. I go to church like two times some week.
We got about a minute left.
You're right, but the point is, most sermons are like grade school level. When I'm listening to Father Michael, it's like a college class. So anybody who wants to listen, you know, to our sermons, it's like listen to. Go to St. Father Michael Pacella or St. Michael's and All Angels.
Okay. And the Father Michael, a question, yes, out in prayer.
Thank you, Lord, that we could help others, talk about things that are a concern to all of us. Lord, we are concerned about our veterans, and I just pray that we could raise the consciousness of those who are in a position to help us and to change things. I pray your blessing on James and Richard, Lord, and all of the veterans that are listening. Lord, may they come to know you in a greater way. For I pray and ask these things in Jesus' name, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen.
Amen. God bless you, everyone, and have a great weekend, and thank you for listening to the show and your mission. Good night.
Good night.
All right, guys, we're off the air now. Padding, good to go. Good night, everybody. Good night, everybody.